Good morning, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. We have another large and I'm sure excellent audience today. We are thrilled. Keep sending that invitation to your friends. So let me introduce you first to the JPC and our work, and then to our speaker. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policy by leading scholars, academics, and commentators. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, and free speech and intellectual diversity. We're starting to worry about that last one. You can read our publications, Insight articles, the In Context blog, Alliance Tracker, Frontline Defense, and our magazine In Focus online at our website, www.jewishpolicycenter.org. That's www.jewishpolicycenter.org. And speaking of In Focus, Ilya Shapiro, our guest today, and a member of the JPC Board of Fellows, has written two extraordinary articles about the Supreme Court in the magazine. Go back and look them up, if you will. It's worth your time. The more recent one is The Supreme Court, Too Important, in the fall 2018 issue. And before that, it was Confirmation Chaos and Constitutional Corruption in the summer of 2016. Ilya is director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute and publisher of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Before joining Cato, he was a special assistant and advisor to the multinational force in Iraq on rule of law issues. We could do a whole session on that one. And he practiced law at Patton Boggs and Cleary Gottlieb. Ilya is the author of an upcoming book, September 20th, it comes out, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. Go pre-order it at Amazon. It's good for authors when you pre-order. Go do that now.
And if you let me know, I can send you a book plate that my publisher has sent. So who knows what I'm doing in-person signings, but I can send you, you know, a signature.
Terrific. Let's do it. Okay, everybody go on and do that. He has contributed to all the academic, popular, and professional publications you would imagine and provides commentary for media outlets, including CBS News, where he is a legal consultant. Ilya has testified before Congress and the state legislatures. He has filed more than 300 friend of the court briefs at the Supreme Court. He has lectured on behalf of the Federal Society. He was an inaugural Washington Fellow at the National Review Institute and Lincoln Fellow at the Claremont Institute. He's been an adjunct law professor at George Washington University and the University of Mississippi. He is the chairman of the Board of Advisors of the Mississippi Justice Institute, a barrister in the Edward Coke Appellate Inn of Court, and a member of the Virginia Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. In 2015, I love this one, he was named by the National Law Journal as one of its 40 under 40 list of rising stars. All of those are impressive, but add to them the fact that Ilya has appeared on the Colbert Report. That's a whole different level of thing. So before I turn the floor over to him, let me remind you, we welcome your questions, but your microphones are not on. So if you have a question, send them to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org. And now, Ilya, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, Shoshana. I'm delighted to be participating in my first forum of this kind for GPC. I guess I've been on the Board of Advisors for a couple of years and really have enjoyed my affiliation with the organization and dealing with you and publishing those articles and otherwise. The Colbert Report appearance was a decade ago. I think it was 10 years ago last week. And that was basically the pinnacle of my career. It's been all downhill since then. Well, let's get right into it. This is the year that it really became the Roberts Court. Chief Justice John Roberts presided over Donald Trump's impeachment trial. Remember that? Seems like a couple of lifetimes ago. Navigated the court through an unusual pandemic-driven telephonic oral argument session, complete with toilet flushes and justices forgetting to unmute themselves. You know, they're just like us. And he was in the majority more than anyone, all but two cases, including 12 of the 13 5-4 decisions. Maybe most notably, he shocked court watchers by joining the liberals on three key cases involving LGBT rights, DACA, and abortion. That, plus Justice Neil Gorsuch's writing the opinion in that Title VII sexual orientation gender identity case, set off a circular firing squad on the right as so-called common good constitutionalists went after originalists and textualists. But actually, when you look at the numbers, it was a pretty good term for conservatives. Of the 13 5-4 decisions, 9 had the conservative justices together, and only 3 had a conservative defect to join the progressives. Compare that to the previous term, when of the 20 5-4 cases, 8 of them had a conservative justice defecting to join the liberal, and only 7 where the conservatives stuck together. Now, losses in big, high-profile cases sting, of course, but this is by no means a liberal court, which is why progressives breathe sighs of relief, but aren't treating Roberts as the second coming of Anthony Kennedy, let alone David Souter. The term had a record low number of opinions, just 53 signed opinions, the lowest in over a century. You actually have to go back to the Civil War to find a lower number. This production decrease was, of course, caused by the cancellation of the March and April sitting, shifting a dozen cases into next term. And the court's 10 arguments in May, those telephonic live stream remarkable arguments, were the first time since 1997 that the court actually heard May arguments, and more arguments in May in over half a century. And of course, the delayed calendar pushed the opinion releases into the second week of July. I mean, typically I'm start doing these Supreme Court reviews, right around the 4th of July or even before. Well, now we had overtime, I guess, because the justices had no place to go like the rest of us. The last time the court released 9 decisions in July was 1986. But anyway, back to John Roberts. He was in the majority, as I said, all but two cases, 97% of the time. The only other justice who participated in at least 50 cases in a term and who was in the majority that much in the last 15 years was, surprise, surprise, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who did it 3 times. Before Kennedy, the most recent justice to be in the majority that many times was Bill Brennan in 1968. So this is really a remarkable year. Now, Roberts isn't a true swing vote, even though this term he went with the progressives in 5-4 rulings more than any other conservative. That was only twice, as I said. Instead, I think you can think of Roberts as what Adam Feldman of Empirical SCOTUS and SCOTUS blog calls the anchored justice. That is, his tendency to vote in the majority and kind of drag the court with him. As for the others, Kavanaugh was in the majority 93% of the time, Gorsuch 89%, and everybody else was below 80. Not surprisingly, perhaps Roberts and Kavanaugh were also the justices most likely to agree. So we really do have that center-right majority of the court. It is not, as some people called it, the Kagan court or something like that. And finally, oral arguments are becoming really interesting. In the post-Scalia world, you know, there was a question of what would they do with all that free time, because Scalia asked a lot of questions. He was, you know, famous for being funny and all the rest of it. Well, Justice Sotomayor has solidified her as the most frequent questioner. Even on the phone, when they switch it up, it wasn't kind of a free-for-all, but they asked questions by order of seniority, she still used the most time. Although Kagan was the fastest talking in terms of most words per second. Anyway, you can drill down on all these quirky stats about the court. Let's get into some of the cases before I turn it over for your questions. This was supposed to be finally a big term for the Second Amendment. The court for a decade had not taken up any Second Amendment cases. The thinking was nobody knew where Kennedy was going to be, and so neither side wanted to pull the trigger, as it were, and take up one of these cases. There's 9 justices. It takes 4 votes to take up a case, right? 5 for a majority to decide it before to take it up. And so finally, once Kennedy retired, Kavanaugh replaced him. They took up this case called New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City. About the narrowest type of Second Amendment case they could take. The only rule of its kind was in New York, where you could not transport your lawful firearms beyond city limits. If you're going to a shooting competition or a training range, a second home, even moving out of the city, you couldn't bring your firearms with you. Bizarre. Didn't exist anywhere else in the country. The city actually successfully defended its rule through two levels of review. But once the Supreme Court took the case, all of a sudden, gun control advocates were wary and afraid of what the Supremes would do. And so New York City reversed its rule, and the New York State Legislature passed a law saying no municipality can have such a rule. Ultimately, then, the Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, decided that the case was moot. Some controversy in that opinion, presumably by Chief Justice Roberts, but joined by Kavanaugh, who said, look, I totally sympathize with the dissent. I think lower courts are not implementing, not enforcing, not defining the Second Amendment correctly, but we have lots of other cases that we can take up. What happened a few months later? Well, the court denied all 10 petitions involving the Second Amendment, all sorts of challenges to regulations. The same day, they also denied a slew of qualified immunity cert petitions. This has come up in the protests and movement for police reform. Justice Thomas notably was in dissent from the denial of both of these areas of law, both the Second Amendment and qualified immunity, which means the liability, not just of police, but all government officials, including university administrators, K-12 principals, what have you. The same day that the court denied all of these petitions, it decided Bostock versus Clayton County. This is the employment discrimination for sexual orientation and gender identity. This is a Title VII case, meaning from the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And the question was whether the ban on employment discrimination because of sex includes gender identity and sexual orientation. A really neat textualist argument between Justice Gorsuch and the majority, Justices Kavanaugh, Alito, Thomas in dissent, whether, you know, Kavanaugh accuses Gorsuch of being too literalist, because in a sense, even in 2020, we don't talk about someone being fired for being gay as being fired on the basis of their sex. Now, conservatives, again, were up in arms about, you know, what does this mean? You know, the Gorsuch betrayal, what have you, what does this mean for religious liberty? Well, later on, Gorsuch wrote the most protective of religious liberty opinions in concurrences in a series of cases, whether involving employment discrimination of a church school, whether involving school choice and tax credits to allow people to send their kids or use scholarships in sectarian or religious schools, or Little Sisters of the Poor. These poor nuns still are being hounded to pay for birth control that they object to. Anyway, big wins, typically by more than 5-4 votes on religious liberty. Now, when it comes to abortion, first of all, this June medical case was not about reconsidering Roe versus Wade or Casey versus Planned Parenthood versus Casey. It was about a Louisiana regulation requiring physicians who performed abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. Interestingly, the court just 4 years earlier had struck down a very similar Texas law in a case called Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. That was a 5-3 vote after Scalia passed, with Kennedy joining the liberals. Chief Justice Roberts was in dissent. Well, here he was in the majority, but only in the judgment. He still disagreed with the left's arguments about why this regulation was okay, but said for purposes of stare decisis, sometimes we keep things that we don't like for stability in the law. He's going to vote to keep it. A curious decision, because not only was he in dissent just 4 years earlier, but it's not like he has a history of never overturning precedent. For that matter, in major cases, overturning more entrenched precedent, whether Citizens United or Janus or Nick, property rights, First Amendment, these different issues, he had no problem overturning 30, 40-year-old precedent and writing about why. But here he preserves on that ground, and for the first time voting to invalidate an abortion restriction, for that matter. So we'll see what happens. You know, the next kind of abortion regulation, he might go back to his other ways, but a curious situation to be sure. The thinking is he's voting strategically to make the court look less partisan and also less ideological, which brings us to another one of these types of cases, the DACA case, Department of Homeland Security versus Regents. Now, I'm not gonna go into the nitty gritty of this. The court, 5-4, Roberts' opinion, decided that even though President Obama used an executive action to pass DACA, President Trump, the administration did not sufficiently explain why it was rescinding the opinion. I actually got some notoriety for my brief in this case because it was styled on the cover. This is an unusual thing for you non-lawyers listening, very unusual to have on the cover, supporting DACA as a matter of policy, but the administration as a matter of law, because if you live by the pen and the phone, you should die by the pen and the phone. But this kind of plays into Roberts' minimalism. Just like a year ago on the census question, he said, yeah, we're not going to allow it this way, but there is a proper way to do it. So this will eventually turn on presumably whether President Trump gets reelected. Or, of course, the president earlier this week or end of last week said that he was about to sign a bill, really another executive order, doing something with immigration. So we'll see what happens to that. And finally, the big Trump subpoena cases that were decided on the last day of the term last week. These cases involve the issue of whether the Constitution protects the president against subpoenas issued by first a congressional committee and then a state grand jury. And both of these ended up being 7-2. So the chief cobbled together these broad coalitions, and it was sort of a split decision. In Vance v. Mazars, the court held that the Article II, the Supremacy Clause, federalism does not categorically preclude, or rather does not give absolute immunity to the president from the issuance of state criminal subpoenas, nor is there kind of a heightened standard. So now that goes back to the grand jury, back to the New York state courts for whatever other defenses the president's counsel might throw up. Not executive privilege, because this has nothing to do with his official capacity, but you know whether this will respond to these subpoenas or dealing with this will detract from his constitutional responsibility, that sort of thing. We will not see his tax returns or other financial matters before the election. The other case, Trump versus Mazars, on the other hand, was a win for the president in the sense that the court said these House committees were overly broad. This is a fishing expedition, and they really have to define with specificity what they're looking for, make clear that why this is necessary, and they can't get the information some other way. Is there really a legislative purpose? You can't just have this catch-all oversight, notably during argument. The House's lawyers refused to name any limit on what Congress could subpoena. So those are effectively the major cases. Next term, we have a few big ones lined up already, including reconsidering Obamacare and the individual mandate, deja vu all over again, whether the House Judiciary Committee can get the Mueller investigations, grand jury materials, if Philadelphia can ban Catholic social services from its foster program because they won't place with gay couples. None of these will be argued, let alone decided, before the election, by the way. And if you want to learn about all of these cases, looking back, looking forward, make a note to watch Cato's Constitution Day symposium. We're not sure whether we'll have the speakers in person, but the audience will be virtual. September 17th, Constitution Day, and that's when we'll also be releasing the latest volume of the Cato Supreme Court Review. And as Shoshana nicely mentioned, it also coincides with the release of my new book, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations, and the Politics of America's Highest Court. And so with that, we've bid adieu to the Supreme Court until October, except that, as I mentioned, this summer, the justices, like the rest of us, aren't going anywhere. So I'm happy to answer or dodge any questions you might have at this point. Shoshana gave you the email address. I'm sure you can put it in the Zoom chat or Q&A. There's different ways that you can reach us, but I take it, Shoshana, you'll field them and ask me.
I will field them and ask them. Give me a high sign if you're planning to duck a question. Okay, just so that I know. Okay, so we did have a question based on your discussion of Bostock. Somebody has asked us, what is textualist jurisprudence? Right. Was that the approach of the late Justice Antonin Scalia?
So textualism is simply looking at the text of the statute. When it was enacted, what are the meaning of the words when it was enacted? It's sort of like originalism, but for statutory law as opposed to constitutional. And yes, Scalia was very much a textualist. As I said, the debate in this particular case was because of sex, discrimination because of sex, what does that mean? Gorsuch says, well, sexual orientation, gender identity, those things are inextricably connected to sex. And Kavanaugh and Alito respond Well, yes, but that's being a little too literalist. Discrimination on the basis of sex, that phrase doesn't generally refer to these other kinds of discrimination. And by the way, it doesn't matter. Neither side was saying that it mattered that in 1964, when Congress passed the law, you know, what the legislators had intended. This is not about legislative intent, nor legislative history. Some committee report or something that somebody introduced, placed into the record. Those are all, not, as Justice Scalia liked to put it, not the law. We just try to judge what the law is. So this is a very interesting debate among textualists.
Thank you. So you're not ducking that question. Thank you. Question from a listener. In the religious liberty cases, were they decided on constitutional grounds or based on statutory intent?
Right. Both, depending on the case. So the church-school case, Our Lady of Guadalupe, there's been a long time precedent that religious organizations of certain kinds, houses of worship certainly, but also things like schools and social service missions and things like that, are exempt from certain employment protections if the person involved is a minister. Now, by minister, that's broader than simply being a priest or a rabbi or an imam, you know, not simply the kind of, you know, someone standing in front of the congregation teaching or preaching. This particular case was about the scope of that ministerial exemption. Basically, the court said, and this all comes from the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause, said that if part of the teacher or other employee's duties is to teach or advocate or encourage students or others to live a life of faith, that sort of thing, then they come under this ministerial exemption. And by the way, this case did not involve some culture war claim. This is not some LGBT claim or contraceptive or abortion. One of these women pleaded age discrimination. Another one talked about they fired her, didn't renew her contract because she took a leave for illness. So this is broader than just Title VII employment discrimination, what we're more familiar with, but kind of the full range of federal protections for employees. And then Little Sisters of the Poor is an administrative law case. Did the relevant agencies, HHS and otherwise, have the authority under Obamacare and its associated regulations to promulgate exemptions for certain nonprofit religious orders? Very technical sort of case. And it's remarkable that this, of the three cases, the other one was Espinoza and school choice, also a First Amendment case. But the Little Sisters, very technical admin law case, got more attention as denying women health care, where all it meant was these religious orders, where, by the way, no employee has actually complained. This is not an employee of the nuns who's complaining. It's the state of New Jersey and Pennsylvania, where they don't want to pay for these certain medicines and devices. So pretty broad rulings in all of these cases, except for the school choice one, which was 5-4.
Thank you. Question here about one that you didn't mention, and that is the Eastern Oklahoma Indian tribal lands and how those tribal lands get to be administered legally as compared to federal and state law. Did the Supreme Court actually say that the Indians of Oklahoma are a separate country and like they're not Americans anymore? Figure that one out for us.
2 weeks from today, I'm actually going to Oklahoma City and Tulsa. So this concerns the eastern half, which includes Tulsa. So I guess I'm going to have to bring my passport or both passports. I'm a Canadian citizen as well. And, you know, who knows how they relate to each country and what have you. But so the particular case is about criminal prosecution. And there's a federal law called the Major Crimes Act that when an Indian is prosecuted on Indian territory, that is subject to federal as opposed to state jurisdiction. Well, this case held that the relevant treaties didn't transfer the territory properly to Oklahoma in the first place. And so there is only federal or tribal jurisdiction. There is not state jurisdiction, which most directly has an impact on criminal prosecutions. There was jokes on Twitter that all Oklahoma prosecutors, or all, at least those in Tulsa and the eastern half, are now going to be deputized special assistant U.S. attorneys or something like that. Unclear what broader effect on it has. It doesn't have an effect on real property, like if people own houses or businesses or what have you in that part. That doesn't automatically just become tribal land, but it may change to whom they pay their local taxes or who runs their local schools. Oil and gas leases and contracts, not the again, not the real property interest, but who governs that, whether it's Oklahoma Corporation Commission or, again, some tribal authority. Permits for casinos, those types of things will potentially be affected, but it's subject to further litigation, further legislation. Congress might get involved, and indeed cooperative agreements that currently there's a three-way negotiation going on between the state of Oklahoma, the Muscogee Creek Nation, and the federal government. So a lot of questions there, but yes, it's basically that, you know, like those old maps, which would, you know, color or label that part northwest of Texas, west of Arkansas as Indian territory. Well, now we do have that Indian territory again, at least for certain purposes.
Maybe the Redskins can go and play there. I'm not sure.
I've always advocated that they keep, the Redskins keep their name, but just change the logo to a smiling red bliss potato.
Yes. Well, this could be. So a listener notes for us that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been hospitalized again. So with that in mind, the question has come up. It's been observed that life tenure on the court was originally meant to insulate the federal judiciary from political wins. And since life expectancy was lower through most of our history, most judges wouldn't be on the court for prolonged periods. Is life tenure for federal judges still, especially those on the Supreme Court, still a good idea?
Right. There's a lot to unpack there, and I suggest you read my book because that goes into this in
that goes without saying
quite a lot of detail. So life expectancy was lower, but people who were in the legal elite tended to still live a fairly long time. So they might have been appointed on average. Well, it was all over the place. I mean, you had people in their 30s being appointed to the Supreme Court. You had people in their 60s. So it's not that life tenure, or it's not that tenures were significantly greater until the justices appointed in the last about 50 years, since the early 70s, where it just became politicized in a way that it hadn't previously. I mean, in the past, people would leave the court because they didn't like it, or they didn't, well, in the early years, they had to ride circuit literally on horseback to cover trials and appeals in different parts of the country. In terms of term limits, it wouldn't actually change the mix of the court significantly based on the natural political churn of who controls the White House and the Senate. You know, the mix of you know, which party gets to, has how much say over these appointments wouldn't really change over the long term. Maybe people would have slightly more confidence in the court if there weren't octogenarians and nonagenarians on the court, maybe. So it's, you know, worth talking about. But I think it would take a constitutional amendment because there is that part of the Constitution that says they serve during good behavior. Now, there's a very academic argument that you can avoid that. I don't buy it. But anyway, I think I'd rather use political capital if we're going to make constitutional amendments on other things, not that. As for Ginsburg herself, I mean, God bless her, four-time cancer survivor. You know, her trainer has a best-selling book out in the Washington area, at least. I mean, this is what it's come to in terms of the arbitrary nature of when these vacancies arise. But yeah, I'm sure my publisher hopes she holds on at least until about my book release. But we'll see. I mean, for the country's sake, I mean, it would be there'd be rioting in the streets if that vacancy happens before the election.
I suspect that's true. And as a cancer survivor myself, I wish her only good things. So, but you're right on time this morning with news as it's happening, and so that makes us newsworthy. Here's a question for us. There are justices who have disagreed over the appropriateness of Supreme Court justices citing international law to support their rulings. Does making such citations, the question we ask, violate the principle that the federal government is based on the consent of the governed, and foreign law-making bodies, whether countries or institutions like the UN, operate without the consent of American citizens? So can we bring law in, or do we leave their law there?
So most of the time when international or foreign law is cited, those are slightly different things, it's not a problem. If you're interpreting a treaty, it's actually a valid way of interpreting the treaty to see what your other treaty partners, how they interpret it. If you're interpreting an arbitration provision or something that has, that says in it, you know, you need to refer to Turkish law on this particular issue, then obviously you have to do that. It comes up in antitrust cases from time to time. Or for that matter, for it's not bad to look at foreign experience. Well, this isn't judges, but if you're legislating to see how different things work, different policies might work in other parts of the world. Where it's a problem is when it's used to help interpret the U.S. Constitution. Because of course, the meaning of a particular term under the U.S. Constitution might mean something completely different. Or even if you think, you know, well, all humans are the same. And so the meaning or the importance of privacy or how certain healthcare procedures affect the body or the death penalty and dignity, these are constant to the human condition. So why not look to see how other courts have theorized these complex philosophical or ethical conundrums? But of course, those other courts, countries, have different cultures, different legal and ethical traditions. How euthanasia or other types of medical procedures might look in Germany with its particular history is different than how it might look or where our philosophical tradition comes from. So that is indeed a problem. It doesn't seem to be as much of an issue now or a hot debate topic as it was 15, 20 years ago. I'm not sure why that exactly is, perhaps because Roberts, for whatever his faults are, isn't one to tend to do that. And Kennedy's off the court now. Breyer tends to do that a fair bit, but it's died down a little. If you really want a great handle on this debate without going into abstruse law review articles, there's a fantastic debate between Justices Scalia and Breyer at American University Law School in January 2005. And with that information, you can Google it, look it up. It's about an hour, but it's really, you know, accessible and very interesting discussion of that particular issue.
They can do that while they're waiting for your book to come out. They can go listen to it. Yeah. So they have something to do. A listener suggests that Justice Roberts may be operating more like a weather vane on the court, reacting to liberal and news media pressure, and less like an umpire calling balls and strikes, which is what he said in his confirmation hearing. What do you think?
There's not an exact analog to what Roberts is doing. So he's not, you know, there were several Republican appointed justices from the 50s, 60s, 70s, Souter in the early 90s, who sort of moved left in office. Now, Roberts is not doing that. He's not become some sort of liberal. He never was a closet liberal. You know, other than those couple of high profile cases this term, he still is generally on the right. He still dissented in Obergefell, the gay marriage case. Before this year, right, the two Obamacare cases and the census quenching case were really the only high profile ones that you could measure his deviations. Nor is he kind of a squishy moderate like Justice Kennedy, where he's kind of, you know, really his principles are somewhere in the middle. It's more that Roberts is, first of all, restrained, and that restraint and minimalism is more important to him than textualism or originalism or other grand theories of interpretation. But also, as Chief Justice, he feels on his shoulders the burden of making the court look less political, preserving its legitimacy and its institutional reputation. Now, again, we can debate whether he's successful in doing that by how he votes and how he writes opinions and all that, but I think that's what he is thinking. And so he makes these strategic moves in a very small way to, as best he can, as he sees it, to extricate the court from political controversy, to make it look less partisan, particularly in election years. I think that's what's going on.
And we do have a listener who reads In Focus and says, you wrote for In Focus, as the court has allowed both the legislative and executive branches to grow beyond their constitutionally authorized powers, so have the laws and regulations that the court now polices. And the measure of the Supreme Court's success will be the extent to which it plays a role in rebalancing our constitutional order, curbing executive branch overreach, and thereby putting the ball back in Congress's courts and returning power to the states. This goes along, it seems to me, with the American reaction to COVID-19, which is to say that people have suddenly discovered states again. Not all states are the same. Governors are actually different. Do you think there is some chance that the reaction to the pandemic will encourage, first of all, Congress to legislate, but also states to see themselves as actual players here.
There are always fair weather Federalists when there's a Republican in the White House. All of a sudden, especially, you know, Republicans or conservatives tend to be pro-federalism more in general otherwise. And by the way, don't call it states' rights, first of all, because that harkens to Jim Crow and segregation, but also it's just inaccurate. States don't have rights. Individuals have rights. States have powers as delineated by our constitutional structure. But anyway, when a Republican controls the executive branch, all of a sudden states say, oh, well, we need to push back on this. And so even before COVID, we had a lot of state lawsuits against the Trump administration over everything from sanctuary cities to gun policies to, you know, lots of things. And that's very healthy. The rediscovery of state sovereignty in, you know, to you know, our power is divided that way to protect individual liberty after all. So that's great. You know, we'll see what happens when Donald Trump is no longer in office. But yeah, COVID, I think, shows that that you can definitely fault different aspects of both federal and state government reactions. But I don't think it's because of federalism. You know, I don't think, you know, it's kind of funny. People, you don't find too many people saying, well, you know, Trump fell down in terms of this or that, or the, you know, his running of the CDC or what have you, and therefore he should have more power. Therefore, governors shouldn't have these powers, right? That would be a bizarre argument to make. And so I think it's good to have the flexibility, because Manhattan is not the same thing as you know, Wyoming or Texas or what have you. And in fact, now, you know, Manhattan's gone down. So there's, you know, different things, and the same flexibility that federalism has in any area of policy is being shown as a plus with respect to COVID.
We have a question. Can you comment on the legitimacy or the practicality of packing the court, since the Constitution doesn't specify the number?
That's right. Unlike term limits, it does not take a constitutional amendment to change the size of the court. And in our history, we've had as few as 6 and as many as 10 justices, although it's been fixed as 9 for 150 years now. It turns out historically, whenever a president has either succeeded or failed in packing the court, there might be some short-term gain, but long-term, it's politically unhelpful, and it does detract from the court's legitimacy. The last time this was seriously proposed was, of course, under FDR. And now, mind you, this was 1937. He had just been reelected with winning all but 2 states. So this huge landslide. This was the as goes Maine, so goes Vermont election. Huge majorities, super majorities in both the Senate and the House. You know, the height of the New Deal. He's proposing to pack the court because these old men are striking down his New Deal legislation. He proposes this, and even though the legislation is fairly popular, the court packing is not. His own vice president campaigns against it. The chief justice testifies against it. The Democrats in the 1938 election lose 8 Senate seats and over 80 House seats. Now, they still maintain their majorities in both chambers because they just had these huge supermajorities, but it was a huge hit to FDR. Now, he stayed in office. He ended up packing the court the old-fashioned way. Just a few years later, those old men began to retire and die. And so just 4 years after the court packing plan, he had already appointed 5 or 6 justices. Now, what does that mean for today? You know, I think if Democrats take both the Senate and the White House in this fall's election, they would first need to get rid of the filibuster, because there would not be 60 votes to pack the court, and then pass legislation adding 2 seats or however many to do. I think that would meet with a huge political backlash, although in the immediate, I guess, they would seat those 2 new justices. But there is certainly not a kind of common agreement within the Democratic Party about this. Even Bernie Sanders said, this is crazy. That means, you know, the next time Republicans are in power, they'll add more seats, and in 50 years, we'll have 87 justices. I'm not going to do his accent, but he had this good riff on this. And so the primary candidates for the Democrats that were pushing this most strongly did not get very far. So we'll see what happens. But I don't know. They have other priorities before it comes to this, but it would take a lot of political capital. I don't know if they'd want to do it.
So I find myself in agreement with Bernie Sanders. I find that very strange. So we have a few minutes left. And I like to end on a positive note. So think positive here. and go back to this idea of why the court has so much power in our lives today, why people look at the court and go, oh my God. And as you've written, it has to do with executive branch overreach and the failure of Congress to legislate. That's not a sexy issue for elections. How do we get people to talk about what the job of Congress is? The job of Congress, it seems to me, is to pass laws. They don't pass very many. That leaves everything, as you've written for us, that leaves everything in the hands of the courts, because then you go, you know, try to get rid of things you don't like or shore up things you do. How do we get Congress to legislate?
Well, all the branches are guilty. It's not just Congress in a vacuum deciding that we're not going to legislate or we're going to pass these broad laws that defer to the executive branch and these agencies, the writing of the rules by which we actually live. The courts have allowed Congress to get away with that sort of thing. And in the meantime, the executive says, fine, we'll take all this power to write the actual laws. That's fine, Congress. You can go be pundits or whatever it is that you do over there in the Capitol. And so there's this dynamic. It's a vicious cycle. And it didn't happen overnight. It happened over a course of decades. So we have, but before you even get to that dynamic, which I'll return to in a second, you have the centralization of power in Washington in the first place. So the demise of federalism, the pushing up of decision-making on all of these divisive policy and cultural issues from this large pluralistic country we live in into Washington, and then within Washington to the executive branch, to the bureaucracy, that is what contributes to that toxic nature, the imbalance. And that's why I say the court, the judiciary, is really the one that has to start righting the ship, rebalancing both separation of powers and federalism. Because the reason why we have these toxic battles over confirmations, whenever there's a vacancy, what have you, is because every June, we just went through it, and now July, the court decides half a dozen of the most pressing, controversial political issues in the country. There's something wrong with that. It's not supposed to do that. So, you know, it's not going to change overnight. But making tweaks to how the court is structured or how confirmations work or what have you, that's ultimately addressing symptoms, and it's going to be futile, because the ultimate problem is this structural one of centralization of power and then skewing towards the executive, which can only be sued.
That's not exactly a positive answer. I think we'll go with it.
Well, you actually asked, I didn't fully answer your question, because you asked how can we get the people to care? Well, I mean, with rare exception, Republicans have done pretty well in making judges in the Supreme Court an issue. No less in 2016, when there was a live vacancy, of course, and President Trump would not have won had it not been for both in terms of anecdotally and the data from the key swing states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan. I mean, that issue was huge, generally on things like the Second Amendment or abortion or certain other things. But this issue of out of control government, Obamacare, things like that matters as well. The Democrats haven't typically made as much hay over it for various reasons. Clinton did in 92 a little bit. I think this year they will, though, again, overshadowed by COVID and certain other things. It's an organic sort of development in terms of how the court has grown and how power has been skewed. So who knows what motivates different people to vote.
That may not be an optimistic thought, but that is a very sage thought on which to draw the program to close. We don't know really what it is that makes people vote, but as long as they vote, I mean, they've got to vote, right? So as we
not
close-
Not necessarily. I mean, this, that opens up a whole other can of worms, you know? But
Okay, maybe you have to come back and we have to talk
feel
about
good, voting. I suppose, vote, but-
Okay, we're going to have you come back in the future and talk about that. But in the meantime, to the listeners, I want to thank you very much for a really great program, Ilya. This covers a lot of ground and helps us understand what it is that's happening. To the listeners, remember that Ilya Shapiro is the author of an upcoming book, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations, and the Politics of America's Highest Court. Please go pre-order it, and I'm pre-ordering it, and you'll probably find a review of it in Focus when we go down the pike here, but it's a really good idea to do that. Ilya, thank you very much. I hope we'll have you back again.
My pleasure. Have a good summer, everyone.
Thank you.